This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. To begin this part of the program, I'd like us to listen to a recording of James P. Johnson. The tune is Worried and Lonesome Blues. It was a recording of this tune by this artist that helped stoke what would become a lifelong love of music in a boy then about 10 years old. The year was 1921. Here's an excerpt from Worried and Lonesome Blues, written and performed by the father of the stride piano, James P. Johnson. James P. Johnson, Worried and Lonesome Blues. So who was the boy whose life was changed? His name was John Henry Hammond, Jr. John Hammond, of Vanderbilt on his mother's side, grew up to be a music producer and an advocate for civil rights. In addition to James P. Johnson, the artists he championed include Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Bob Dylan, Aretha Franklin, Bruce Springsteen, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. A legendary figure, yet many of us don't know of him, so we're out to change that this afternoon. Our guest is journalist Dunstan Pryle. He's the author of a biography of Hammond. It's called The Producer, John Hammond and the Soul of American Music. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon, Dunstan Pryle. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dunstan Pryle has worked as a reporter for Dow Jones and the Associated Press. His biography of John Hammond, the producer, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Dunstan Pryle, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be here.
The first chapter begins with this sentence. In a home fit for a king, John Henry Hammond, Jr. found sanctuary in the basement with the servants. Why did he feel at home there?
Well, that's a good question. I think he sought solace there. He was an iconoclast. He was a born iconoclast. It didn't come to him. It didn't occur to him at a later date. He was simply born that way. So he's born in a five-story marble mansion, essentially, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, about a half a block off of Central Park. And he's born the grandson of Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt. For those who don't know, the Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt was the robber baron. He wasn't a robber baron. He was sort of the robber baron. He was the Bill Gates of his time. He was the richest man alive around the turn of the century, of the 18th and 19th century.
He was nowhere near as philanthropic as Bill
Gates. No, he was not. He held on to his money.
He sure
did. He could. So there was still a lot of it left by the time John Hammond's mother got married and her family built her a home. It was on his mother's side that he was related to the Vanderbilts, and they built this spectacular mansion up on the Upper East Side up there, and that's where he was born, the youngest of five children, four older sisters, and it was a very traditional sort of Vanderbilt family. They listened to classical music, and they had a box at the opera, etc., and for whatever reasons, John felt more comfortable in the basement listening to that sort of visceral music that you just played, the James P. Johnson, the early jazz, and the blues. And it planted a seed in him that stayed with him for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Now, his mother, actually both of his parents are interesting characters. Mm-hmm. His mother, though, really an interesting woman. Emily Vanderbilt Sloan Hammond.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about her, and how had she become the woman that she was?
She was a profoundly religious woman, and embedded in that sense of religion was a sense of the reformer as well. It wasn't just going to church on Sundays and believing in sort of a sacred entity and what have you. It was an activism. So there was a sense that you given the fortunate circumstances in which they had been born, there was a sense that you needed to give back. And she participated in things like homes for young girls. If young women came to New York City to become entertainers, or they could often lose their way. So Mrs. Hammond actively participated in setting up arrangements for them. And not all of these girls were rich. They would come to New York City to work Broadway or whatever, and if they weren't treated the right way, they could wind up anywhere in the city. And so she participated in things like that. She was involved in the Girl Scouts early on. Her friends were Eleanor Roosevelt, these types. And that fed down to John. It wasn't just a sense of, like I said, you know, going to church on Sundays. There was a sense that you had an obligation to give back, and John carried that on with him.
Yeah. Now, his father, on the other hand, was a very practical man.
He was. He knew what he had married into, and he knew what the obligations of being sort of a Vanderbilt man were, and that was to be a hardworking lawyer, as he was. And he sat on the boards of many of the diverse holdings of the Vanderbilt family, mostly railroads and banking and things like that. And that was ostensibly the path that John Jr. was to follow, go to exclusive private schools, which John did. He went to, I'm losing the name of it now, it's up in Hotchkiss, up in northwestern Connecticut, beautiful school. And Hotchkiss is sort of a feeder to Yale, at least it was at the time, probably still is, I don't really know. But you went from Hotchkiss to Yale, and under the right circumstances, you went on to Yale Law School, and then you went down to Wall Street, and you made more money. And that was the path established for John, but he made it about a third of the way. He made it through Hotchkiss, and he made it a year and a half through Yale, and at that point, he said, "This path is not for me. Music is my path, and I'm not going to learn about music at Yale. I want to go back to New York and go up to Harlem and learn about the music I love, which is jazz."
Yeah. One of the things I admired about his father was that he didn't want his children to rely on the wealth of the family, that they were to get out and make their way in the world.
He did. He established sort of an independence in his kids.
Yeah.
Certainly, there was a lot of money. And it was inherited money. So we all know what can happen with inherited money. It can come with a sense of entitlement. He didn't want his children to have that. And in some instances, you could almost look at it as it sort of backfired with John. His son became too independent, and he stepped way outside of the bounds of what perhaps his father had envisioned. I don't think that his father was ever dismayed. Probably in as far as not finishing school. John never got a college degree, his son. But you're right. This was something that was handed down from his father, a sense of independence and a sense that you had to find your own way and you had to make your own way, that simply because we entitled or we inherited wealth, that didn't – you weren't set for life. You still had to work for a living, and you had to go out and make your own way in the world, and that came from his father.
Mm-hmm.
Who did? His father did work mm-hmm. very hard, and he was a very practical man, and so he instilled that in his son.
Now, John Hammond Jr., not yet out of grade school, he begins going to Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
What was the year, and what was Harlem like at the time?
This would have been about the early 1920s, and in fact, it was really at the dawn of what we came to know as the Harlem Renaissance. And it was really a fabulous time to be in Harlem. There were a lot of middle-class blacks who had moved there from all around the country. There was a thriving entertainment and arts scene going on. The funny thing was that at first I thought this was one of those stories that perhaps was mythology. I didn't really believe that John Hammond at 10, 11, 12 years old had gotten on a bus and gone up Fifth Avenue and hung around, walked around in his short pants, as they say, up in Harlem. And I was very, very fortunate. I was able to interview his sister, who is still very much alive and well up in, she's living up in northern Connecticut. And she confirmed a lot of these stories that, you know, when larger-than-life people, as Mr. Hammond did, write his own autobiography, and people talk about these sorts of people, you believe about half of it. And this is one of these things that I really didn't believe. I thought this was going to have to be one of these myths that I would have to sort of, quash if I was going to write a genuine biography. And being a journalist, I guess that was my obligation. But no, this is a true story. He would get out and get on the bus and go up into Harlem, and apparently he was a polite young kid. And some of the doormen and the extra help around these clubs sort of took him under their wing and would take care of him, make sure that he didn't get in any trouble. If he needed to get a bus, it was getting late or whatever, they would send him on his way. And but he became sort of known up around there, along 125th Street, where the Apollo still is and some of the very famous clubs were. And so he became sort of known up there at a very young age, and it was a true story. Like I said, I didn't really believe it at first, but this was an interesting guy. He got started early, and he stayed with the music for another 7 decades.
Yeah, well, now you mentioned he became a producer, mm-hmm. and a producer's job in part is to promote.
Yes.
And also he was not afraid of promoting himself along
no,
the way.
Not.
So that's something to keep in mind, and that's something that you had to deal with as a journalist.
Sure.
Yeah.
It was not, at the time, he was criticized at the time, I should say, for he was sort of a musical Renaissance man. He had a lot going on. He wrote for some of the very popular musical journals at the time, being Melody Maker and more especially Downbeat, and Downbeat is still around. And he wrote a lot of criticism, and along with that criticism, there was a lot of praise. Some of the folks he was praising were people he was promoting. That would be Benny Goodman, later Count Basie, later especially Count Basie. Charlie Christian, Lionel Hampton, Teddy Wilson, these folks he worked with and recorded and promoted and wrote extremely praiseworthy articles in Melody Maker and Downbeat, and a lot of people saw that as a conflict of interest. They didn't just see it. It was, in fact, a conflict of interest. Now, you had to have known Mr. Hammond, and after 5 years of studying his life, I feel that I know him pretty well. I was never fortunate enough to meet him, but having interviewed as many people as I did and read as much about him as I did and gone through his papers and talked to his family, I feel like I have a pretty good sense of who Mr. Hammond was. And the one thing, all the criticism that was heaped on him throughout his life for various aspects, for his arrogance or hubris or in this case a very specific criticism of participating in conflicts of interest, it's my belief that his heart was always in the right place. And I think if you read my book, you get that sense. He genuinely believed, if he was writing about one of his musicians, that this musician was the finest musician going. If he was writing that about Count Basie and Basie's band, he genuinely believed it. Therefore, he also genuinely believed that it was not a conflict of interest. If I'm a critic and I feel that this is the best musician out there, and I'm writing about him, I'm going to say that he's the best musician out there. The fact that I'm also promoting him, what you could say in defense of Hammond was that he didn't need the money. So he wasn't taking mm-hmm. money from, he wasn't promoting artists making sure that they, you know, in order so that they would make extra money, and then taking kickbacks from them. He didn't need the money. So if he wrote something, it was because he genuinely believed it. Now, was it a conflict of interest? It absolutely was. But it was one of the sort of contradictions of Mr. Hammond that I wrote about. And as I say, as a journalist, you write the good and the bad.
Yeah. And at the same time, John Hammond, as I mentioned in my introduction, is a name you might kind of know a little bit if you're just an ordinary kind of person, such as myself. And I really had no idea who John Hammond was before this book arrived.
Well, I'm hoping, I love to hear that, actually. I really do. I knew who he was because coming of age musically, Dylan was one of the first people who really struck me viscerally. I grew up in New Jersey, so Bruce Springsteen came along, and he was sort of hard to miss over there. And after that, and it was sort of ironic because in the early to mid-'80s, Bruce Springsteen really exploded. He went from being just a rock star to being sort of a genuine American icon. And at that point, a lot of people from New Jersey back in those days had sort of a proprietary feeling toward Springsteen. He's our guy. You know, you guys can listen to him, but he's our guy. But once Born in the USA came out and he really did become this American figure, a lot of us, people like me, said, okay, you can have him for now. We're going to go listen to some other stuff. And what I did, I turned on the radio at that point, and what came out was Stevie Ray Vaughan. And that his music just, it was very different than Dylan's and Springsteen's in that it was really sort of it's guitar, you know, it's blues rock guitar. And the lyrics aren't as prevalent or as important to Stevie Ray. And a little bit of research, and I discovered, well, here's this link. There's this link between these three artists who have meant so much to me over the past 10 or 15 years, and this link is John Hammond. That's how I first learned about him. When I got a little bit more interested and thought, as I was becoming a writer myself and a journalist, it fascinated me to find out all the rest of this history. I mean, when you talk about Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan and Stevie Ray Vaughan, with Mr. Hammond, you're merely scratching the surface.
Right.
And that was very important to me because if you're going to do something like I did, you spend 5 years on it, and it's a long haul. So there better be a lot there to keep you interested. And with Mr. Hammond there, it just never, I could have spent 10 years, you know? I mean, he had, like I said, musically, you're just scratching the surface with Dylan and Springsteen and Stevie Ray Vaughan. They're really three of the last artists that he worked with. You've also got Aretha Franklin in there. But that didn't even take into account the whole jazz element. And for me, that was a lot of fun because I grew up as a rock and roll guy. The jazz was there, and I knew these names. But working on this project forced me to go back and really expand and educate myself to this wonderful music from the 30s. And that I had a couple of years where I just immersed myself in swing jazz, you know, the Benny Goodman, starting really I started at the beginning. I went right to Louis Armstrong, and then I went on to Fletcher Henderson, and then I got to Benny Goodman, and I got to Count Basie and Christian and all of this fabulous music, which, who knows, maybe I never would have gotten around to if it hadn't been for this project for me. Beyond that, I had no idea that it was Mr. Hammond who, without exaggerating, pretty much single-handedly was responsible for integrating popular music in the 30s. And I don't exaggerate when I say that.
Yeah.
I had no idea about any of that.
Yeah.
So all these different elements kept me going for a long time. And when people come to me and say, wow, you know, I knew about Hammond, and I knew he played a big role in 20th century music, but I had no idea he was as significant as he was. It's gratifying to me to know that I'm sort of enlightening folks to what this guy was all about.
Yeah. Also, his worldview, very important, and we should talk about this. In addition to Melody Maker and Downbeat, he wrote for The Nation.
He did.
And one of the assignments he received was to report on the second Scottsboro trial.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that case and the kind of reporting he did on the trial.
Sure. Well, the Scottsboro case was one of the most significant trials. I don't want to call it the O.J. Simpson trial of its time. It was about as equally as possible, equally popular. Everyone was following it, and in a sense, it was similar to that because it had the same sort of giant racial overtones to it. It was at least 6 or 8 young black kids who were arrested for allegedly brutally raping 2 white Southern girls. Now, all of the evidence pointed in the direction that these kids were innocent and that it had just been sort of a coincidence that these 2 young girls and all these black kids had been on the train together. But they were arrested down south. The girls made the accusations, and by God, the prosecutors were going to make their case against these kids. And it's been a couple of years now. I can't remember the exact how the first trial went and what have you, but this was a case that went on for years and years, and it split the country in half. Down south, they were guilty. Up north, they were not guilty. And, of course, Hammond went down as a very left-leaning writer from the mm-hmm. north to expound upon this for the nation. And he was only 23, 24 at the time, very young kid. And he wrote, it was journalism, but it was the sort of opinion essay journalism that Hammond wrote his entire, he didn't do the kind of journalism that, say, I do, where it's ostensibly it's objective, or you do your best to be objective. Hammond, everything Hammond ever wrote was laced with his own opinions. And he wrote some very articulate articles with a very broad view of what the community was like down in Alabama where the trial was held, what the prosecutors were like, what the defense attorneys were like. It was very prescient stuff and very articulate and very eloquent for a guy as young as he was. And it's my sense and my belief that when he did this stuff at 23 or 24, mm-hmm. it set him very far apart from his peers who were writing jazz criticism. There were guys like George Frazier and George Simon who were his peers writing about Benny Goodman and Woody Herman and Artie Shaw. Hammond goes down and he writes this stuff for the nation, and it sets him apart. It begins to sort of establish his career as a well-known civil rights activist. And like I said, he was a young guy when he was doing this.
Yeah, just in
the path for him.
In his 20s.
Yeah, it was in his early 20s. And I was lucky. I was able to track the transcripts of the articles he wrote down, and I read them. And I guess I was in my mid 30s or something at the time. I said, "Wow, he had a leg up on me. He was in his early 20s. It was pretty good stuff."
Yeah. When and how did John Hammond come to believe that music could be the path to civil rights, to integration?
I think it was another one of these things that it wasn't like the electric light bulb going off over his head. It was something that was instilled in him. He saw early on sort of the visceral power of music and how it could affect people's lives. And what he felt was, his passion was the music, and he loved the music. Now, exactly how he decided that that would be the vehicle for civil rights, it's unclear. There, like I said, there's no sort of epiphany that he had. It was, again, from a very early age, he determined, it was Teddy Wilson was the fellow that he used to place with Benny Goodman's band. And my analogy has always been that Hammond saw in Teddy Wilson the same qualities that Branch Rickey saw a decade later in Jackie Robinson. And I've used this analogy with other people, and no one has ever said, "Nah, Dunstan, you're exaggerating." I think it's a fair analogy. Teddy Wilson, for those who don't know, is a brilliant piano player. Young black guy at the time, he was probably in his early to mid-20s, and Mr. Hammond heard him playing on the radio out of Chicago and invited him to New York. And after meeting him, he decided almost immediately, this is the fellow. If there's anybody out there who can carry this sort of weight on his shoulders, Teddy Wilson is the guy who can do it. And for a couple of years, Teddy recorded mostly in New York with other black musicians. But fairly early on, this would be about 34, 35, Mr. Hammond started leaning on Benny Goodman to record with Teddy Wilson. Now, Benny Goodman at the time was not as popular as he would become in the later in the 30s, and he was very reluctant to record with Teddy or any black musicians for that matter, because at the time it just wasn't done. Popular music was very segregated, except in after-hours clubs where musicians might get together to jam. But in the recording studios and the radio stations, and most decidedly on stages, on the nightclub stages, whites played with whites and blacks played with blacks. Mr. Hammond's instincts told him, and again, there's no epiphany moment. There's not a light that goes off somewhere. His instincts told him that people loved good music, and they would love good music regardless of who it came from. And it took him about a year, maybe 2 years, to convince Goodman of that belief. But eventually Goodman came around and started recording with Teddy, and then invited him on stage with him out in Chicago at the Congress Hotel. And a very famous, I think it was Easter of 1936, Sunday afternoon. And that was it. It broke down the racial barrier. After that, Lionel Hampton joined the band, the black vibraharpist. And then twisting over, after Goodman invited two black musicians to join him, black musicians, black bands started inviting white musicians to join them. So it really went both ways. And by the late 30s, you had a complete integration going on. And I don't think Hammond ever got enough credit for it. And Lionel Hampton, I was fortunate enough to interview him shortly before his death. He said the same thing to me a few times in our several interviews, that he never thought that Hammond and Goodman got enough credit for doing what they did. And Branch Rickey has sort of gotten, become an icon for the civil rights folks, and Hammond did the same thing for music 10 years earlier.
And also, I think we should emphasize here that Hammond just had a great ear.
Oh, he sure did.
He, thinking of Teddy Wilson, he paired Teddy Wilson and Billie Holiday, and who else?
Oh, he paired, the original trio was Teddy Wilson, Benny Goodman, and Gene Krupa. And for those who are familiar with Benny Goodman's sound, as a lot of people from our generation are, it's the real sort of bombastic, large band arrangements. And what Mr. Hammond pushed Benny to do was more of the elegant chamber style music, which Teddy just excelled at. When Lionel Hampton later joined the band, the Goodman Trio became the Goodman Quartet. Charlie Christian later joined it and became the Benny Goodman Septet. But this was very soft music. It was not the bombastic stuff, really, that Goodman, you know, any of the movie soundtracks from World War II or whatever, the stuff that we're all sort of instantly familiar with. You'd have to go to the record store, go online or wherever to find this stuff, but it's absolutely gorgeous stuff. Goodman or Mr. Hammond also paired up something else. One of the great treats for me of this project, like I said, I got my education in jazz, but it was more than that. Goodman or Hammond paired up Billie Holiday with Lester Young. Now, for those who don't know who Lester Young was, he was sort of the star saxophonist for Count Basie's band, and he's an absolute icon in the world of jazz. He was ahead of Charlie Parker and ahead of everybody. Some people call him the original hipster. He was just a fascinating figure in jazz, and he's one of the real signature voices of the swing era and going on into bebop. And Hammond paired up Billy with Lester on some absolutely fabulous albums. If Columbia has some whole CDs dedicated to the music of Billie Holiday and Lester Young, and if you're out there listening and you want to hear some absolutely sublime jazz. Pick up some of that. I could go on and on. I mean, he paired up Charlie Christian with Benny Goodman's band. Like I say, just as he did that, that's what he did. When we think of Mr. Hammond, some people have asked me about the name of the album, the name of my book is The Producer. Mr. Hammond was not a producer in the sense that we now think of a producer. He didn't twiddle the knobs and fool with the dials in order to create a sound. What Mr. Hammond saw his role as the producer was bringing together great musicians and seeing what happened. And what I've just been sort of rambling on about for the last 5 minutes is what he absolutely excelled at was bringing, using his instincts to bring musicians together and then letting them experiment and see what happened. And in most cases, the results were absolutely sublime.
Mm-hmm. Dunstan Pryle is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of The Producer, John Hammond and the Soul of American Music. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions or comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Hammond could be very tough on African-American artists.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote some articles that were very tough on Duke Ellington.
He was, yeah. Now, this is perhaps where his confidence in himself could arguably have crossed over into the area of hubris. And there was a very famous article that he wrote, an essay really, I think it was first published in the Brooklyn Eagle and later and republished shortly thereafter in Downbeat, in which he essentially took Duke Ellington to task for not taking enough responsibility for his fellow African Americans. Mr. Hammond's take on this was that Duke was prominent enough that he could stick his neck out for the rest of the race. Now, again, the sort of hubris that it takes to write something like that, coming from a scion of the Vanderbilt family,
mm-hmm.
you know, he never really had to work for anything. Hotchkiss and Yale were in his path, whether he liked it or not, and criticizing Duke Ellington, who absolutely had to work for everything he got. He's a black man living in a segregated white world. It's really sort of astonishing that Hammond would take that approach, but that was who he was, and he felt he was right, and off he went with it. Ellington, being Ellington, didn't even dignify it with a response. He waited a couple of years before he wrote his own essay for Downbeat, and in Duke's inimitable way, it was a very eloquent, very low-key response, saying essentially critics are out there to criticize and to provoke, and folks like John Hammond do that. They don't have a whole lot of business telling musicians what they should do, let alone how they should act. And it was a very elegant, articulate response to a really an uncalled for broadside on Hammond's part. Again, Hammond felt he was right, so he did it. So I you have to sort of admire him for that, but sometimes the ends don't justify the means, and Hammond sometimes went over the line.
Yeah. What was it like to work with John Hammond? What did artists think of him?
For the most part, they enjoyed it very much because Hammond trusted his instincts. And if he selected you to work with you, he believed in you. And if he believed in you, he would essentially leave you alone, which is why some people have suggested that the title, the producer, is sort of a misnomer. When he brought you into the recording studio, he basically closed the door and said, "Go ahead, guys, make your music." So musicians enjoyed that level of confidence and the ability to be sort of left alone and to do what they did best. Hammond never fancied himself a musician. So when you got in there with him and he felt that you were doing, he would walk off and go read a magazine or do whatever it was he was doing. So to have that sort of confidence, to not be told, well, you should be playing this or playing that, or you were flat there, that was not Hammond's role. He also expressed a great deal of faith in his musicians, as that becomes more prevalent and more prominent later in his career when he was sort of taking big risks. I mean, you invite folks like Teddy Wilson, Charlie Christian, but I should retract that, because Billie Holiday, one of his very first sort of genuine discovery was Billie Holiday, and she was revolutionary for her time. Now she's sort of the bar by which, you know, the standard by which most jazz singers are measured. But at the time, her sort of singular phrasing where she follows the beat and she had a very sort of low-key approach to singing, no one sang like that really at the time. So Hammond had to really get behind her before he would convince anyone to record her. Now, when you're talking about people like Count Basie and Lester Young and Teddy Wilson, these people were brilliant musicians. So they didn't need any guidance, and you didn't really need to convince record executives to record these folks. But let's fast forward 30 years, and you bring in some kid named Bob Dylan, who's no one's ever heard of before. He's not a very good guitar player. He's not a very good singer. He doesn't play the harmonica all that well. Why should we sign a contract with this guy? Why, his first album doesn't do very well. Why should we let him record another album? Well, because Mr. Hammond said so, and Mr. Hammond is now in the early 60s. He's a legend at Columbia Records. He's got this jazz behind him. People know he's a very, very prominent figure in the music industry. When Dylan didn't really, when people didn't respond to Dylan early on, Columbia wanted to dump him, and it was Mr. Hammond alone who got behind Dylan and said, "This guy is going to be a significant artist, and you need to stick with him." He did the same thing for Springsteen, too. There were some voices at Columbia who were not thrilled with Springsteen's early albums and thought, let's not invest any more money in this. And for Mr. Hammond, it was never about the money. He said, these guys are lasting, genuine, important artists. You need to stick with them. It may not be one album, it may not be two albums, but you need to have the faith, and you need to stick with them. And so you need to only talk to Bruce Springsteen for a couple of minutes to get the sense of what it was like to have Mr. Hammond behind you. And he was nothing, extremely flattering about his relationship with Hammond.
Yeah. Well, the piece that we opened this portion of the program with earlier, Worried and Lonesome Blues, from James P. Johnson, on this LP that was loaned to us by the FM, WILL-FM, mm-hmm. station director, Jake Schumacher. There's a liner notes include some comments from the music critic and historian Stanley Dance, mm-hmm. and he wrote, 10 of the performances in this collection, all previously unissued in the U.S., were recorded by John Hammond in 1939. Mm. They were rejected at the time as being uncommercial, an accusation which often really meant too good, as John knew.
Yeah. Well, I guess a lot of the stuff that Hammond worked with over the years was it was ahead of its time, and you could start with Billie Holiday. People didn't understand where she was coming from. She was new. Her sound was innovative, and he had to convince Benny Goodman again. I mean, Benny was sort of his launching pad for quite a number of things back in the early and mid-30s. But because he and Benny had a good relationship together, he was able to convince Benny to record with Billy and allowed Billy to sing on a couple of Benny's early recordings. And a few years later, it was the same thing with Charlie Christian. Charlie Christian was well ahead of his time with what he was doing with the electric guitar through most of the 30s, and especially for during the swing era, the guitar was essentially a rhythm instrument, almost a percussion instrument, where you kept rhythm with it. That was what it was called, rhythm guitar. Now, Charlie Christian comes along, and he's the innovator of the, or one of the early innovators, perhaps the best at it in any case from that era, of playing single note leads and moving the guitar from the back of the bandstand to the front of the bandstand. You're now soloing on the electric guitar. Nobody'd really heard of that before, and people were reluctant to listen to it or accept it. This was another Hammond discovery, Charlie Christian out in Oklahoma City. And again, he convinces Benny Goodman, you got to have this guy in your band. He's going to be an asset. This is the way things are going. Goodman is at first reluctant. Hammond is persistent, and Charlie Christian becomes Charlie Christian. Dylan Springsteen, I could go on and on and on.
Yeah. He was drafted into the military during World War II, and at the time, as we all know, it was a very segregated military. And here he crusaded again for change.
Mm-hmm.
Then, after the war, along comes bebop.
Mm-hmm. Well, when Mr. Hammond goes in, sort of, World War II is sort of the end of the swing era,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Hammond is in his early 30s. At this point, and he's drafted at the end of the war, and he goes in, and his job in the military is sort of as he's assigned various camps to be sort of a morale booster for the black troops. And if you read the book, even he sort of took sort of a wry approach to it. He saw quickly what was happening, and he saw the irony in the role of the black soldier during World War II. Here we were out fighting for global freedoms and fighting against tyranny and for democracy and what have you, and yet here at home we treated blacks horribly. And he saw that on the military bases that he worked at around the country. And what he did at those military bases on a small scale, I don't think he felt that he could necessarily integrate the entire military. That was sort of a big job.
Yeah.
What he would do was, because of his connections in the music industry, he would invite prominent musicians, be it Ella Fitzgerald or whomever, or Count Basie, to whatever band he was, or to whatever base he was working at, or assigned to, and then say to the camp superiors, well, they'll come and they'll perform for the troops, but only if you allow an integrated audience. So he would use his leverage and ability to get these bands to come perform to integrate, at least even if it was just for a few hours. You know, that was important to him. Whereas without his influence, a band like Basie or Ella Fitzgerald or somebody might, and perform for an all-white audience, and then maybe later for an all-black audience. Hammond said, no, we're not going to have any of that. They'll only come if they can play for an integrated audience. And it's a small victory, but a victory nevertheless. Now, getting to your point about bebop, when he gets out of the army, everything has changed, and bebop has taken over, and it sort of left him without a mission for a few years. But he did all right. He worked the latter part of the 40s as a record company executive for a couple of small labels, Mercury, I believe. I forget the other names. But that was not his calling. He was a music guy, and to be sort of up in an office signing contracts and things like that was never real. He did that, but more he enjoyed working with the artists.
And then it was rock and roll and rhythm and blues that got him back as a player.
One thing I wanted to add, though, hopefully there's a few people out there listening, and one of the overlooked aspects of Hammond's career is the 50s. A lot of people, and some of the critics the reviewers who've read the book and written about it, sort of suggest that Hammond was in early retirement during the 50s, and it couldn't have been farther from the truth. He actually was working for Vanguard Records, and Vanguard is obviously not Columbia or Atlantic or any of the big companies, but it's a boutique sort of label, and it remains that way to this day. Now, boutique meaning that they make wonderful albums for a limited audience. And during the 50s, Hammond made beautiful recordings, mostly in New York, but with some. He mixed. He went back to his swing days and got guys like Basie and some Buck Clayton, Mel Powell, some of the bigger names who worked with the big swing bands. But he also got some newcomers, guys like Ruby Braff, who's a guy out of Boston, was a young trumpet player. And he brought them together and made sort of a mix between the beautiful swing jazz that Hammond was known for and the bebop that was going on. It was somewhere in between that. Since he was not a fan of bebop and swing was over, you had to find a middle ground, as it were. And Hammond achieved that. He made some beautiful, beautiful albums for Vanguard during the 50s that have been overlooked outside the somewhat insular jazz world. But if you look up Vanguard and find those records, they've re-released them all, and it's really gorgeous stuff. I always like an opportunity to talk about that because I do feel it's an overlooked part of Hammond's career, and some of that stuff is just absolutely gorgeous.
Well, I'm glad you got that in, because now we've got to wrap up. We're out of time.
Okay.
Dunstan Pryle, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Dunstan Pryle is the author of The Producer, John Hammond and the Soul of American Music. The book is published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux.